This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, the very best bits of today's show. It is a Wednesday morning, 29th of May. Lots of breaking news this morning from Asia, economic news. So we've got the IMF raising its China growth forecast and Australian inflation going to get reaction from Khatija Haque, the economist. What else have we got for you? Travel trends for Eid al-Fitr and summer. Brandy's been talking with the travel expert Emily Jenkins. Poland, apparently. Surprisingly, top of the list for Eid al-Adha. What else? Really enjoyed our interview with John Reed, Chief Market Strategist of the World Gold Council. Yeah, we did all the kind of stuff about gold at record prices and Fed and all that kind of gear. But I really enjoyed the fact that he's a miner. Spent first 10 years of his career underground in South Africa. So he was talking about the Nubian geological shelf in the Arabian Peninsula and stuff like that. A John Reed interview coming up on the Bite Size podcast. And finally, talking industry. Again, great interview with Saud Abu Al-Sharareb from Dubai Industrial City. They have just released new plots of land for industrial development. It's the size of Karama, for goodness sake. Such is the demand for new factories in Dubai and across the UAE. All that to come. First up, though, that breaking economic news.
Right. Taking a look at some of the breaking news this morning before we get into our interviews. Economic news coming out of Australia this morning. Inflation coming in higher than expected year on year for April, 3.6%. It's not just higher than economists expected. It's also up ever so slightly, but still moving in the wrong direction from March. Now, the RBA, that is the central bank in Australia, the Reserve Bank of Australia, had pretty much ruled out any cuts for this year. But as a result, the FT has been speaking to economists who say they're now asking the question only, whether or not we could even see rate rises.
You could ask the question, I'll give you the answer. No.
But looking at one market analyst, this one in The Guardian, the runway for the RBA to deliver household an early Christmas present in the shape of a December rate cut has narrowed. Thinking a little bit about this and thinking about ECB and the stories yesterday suggesting that they were getting closer to rate cuts, potentially even closer than the Fed. The question being, what happens if we see divergence? I mean, for the last couple of years, we've kind of seen the central banks doing the same thing, albeit some of them faster than the others. If we start to see some proper differences in terms of people starting to cut, not starting to cut, we're going to see differences in currencies. And so we're going to see differences in how much it actually costs to buy and sell stuff that's imported and exported. That's going to be interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, looking at fxstreet.com, one of the big currency exchange websites, and that's exactly what they're leading with this morning. They're looking at the Aussie dollar against the US dollar, and they're saying the Aussie dollar defending its gains after that inflation data. So yeah, if there's a prospect of higher interest rates in Australia, you get the carry trade coming in, and people will buy Aussie dollars to take advantage of those higher yields. There's no question that will become a thing. Look, no one's saying the Aussie dollar has gone through the roof this morning. It hasn't spiked on the back of that news. These are incremental movements, but yeah, definitely a thing.
All right, other news we're seeing this morning. IMF raising its growth forecast for China by about half a percentage point.
Let's get the thoughts of Khatija Haque. She was watching this one closely. Chief Economist, Emirates NBD.
The IMF's upgrade to China's expected growth this year to 5% is welcome, and it should mean stronger global growth and also be positive for oil demand. However, China still faces challenges with excess capacity in its real estate sector and its reliance on exports to drive growth rather than domestic consumption. This is particularly key because the US and Europe are increasingly taking protectionist measures against imports from China. For the UAE, China is a key export market for oil and a major source of imports. Bilateral investments will also be in focus during the state visit this week.
Khatija Haque, Emirates NBD, of course. Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed heading from South Korea to China.
This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Well, we are in a holiday mood this morning. We woke up to windows full of condensation, which gets us thinking about a summer hole. The question is, where are we all going? Not this summer, just this summer rather, but also this Eid. Very pleased to be joined by Emily Jenkins. She's Head of Product Development at DW Travel. Emily, it's lovely to see you. Good morning.
Good morning, Brandy.
Let's start with Eid. Couple of weeks. What are bookings looking like?
So at the moment, we're really seeing that our bookings are more focused on summer break than the Eid break. A lot of our Eid bookings are more for couples than families, which we do believe is because, you know, the Eid break is only a couple of weeks before the school holidays start. The couples we're seeing booking are travelling for maybe 4 to 5 nights, and a lot of the destinations are Poland, London, Austria and Cape Town.
Okay, so it's quite a mixed bag there. How much in advance have people been booking? I mean, last Eid we spoke about the prices absolutely soaring. Does that mean that people booked earlier than usual?
That's an interesting question. We actually conducted a survey back in April of our customers, of DW Travel customers, and we found that the sentiment was very focused around looking for a good deal, budgets, you know, budget travel, and understanding the need to book in advance. Versus, I think, previous years where post-COVID people really focused on experiential bucket list, you know, that revenge travel sentiment. So what we saw in the survey was that about 25% of our customers were saying they planned to book more than 3 months in advance this year. However, on the flip side of that, about 50% still said that they planned to book within a month of departure in the hope of getting a good deal.
Are we getting more budget conscious?
Yeah, so a few other answers within that survey I think really highlighted that to us, because we saw that about 40% of customers were saying that they were only planning to travel once this year, as opposed to, you know, multiple times throughout the year. And 50% of people surveyed also said that they were looking for a budget-friendly option.
Okay, so if you're seeing more bookings for summer, what does that pipeline look like?
So we have seen, actually in line with that survey, that we've seen some really good bookings coming through, you know, within, you know, 3 months in advance for summer. But we are expecting over the next probably week or so that those last minute bookings will start to come in for customers booking for their summer breaks.
And the length of time? I mean, more work from home, more normal, is that reflected?
It's about a 2 to 4 week holiday duration, which is about standard, I would think, for most years.
Right. Well, you know the working hypothesis on the Business Breakfast, which is we think amongst the trends, and it's purely because 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us have booked flights to different cities in Italy. Is it one of the places to go this summer?
Yeah, so our top trending destinations for summer at the moment are London, which is, you know, fairly consistent, Italy, Germany, Switzerland, Thailand, Sri Lanka. We are also seeing some interesting newcomers in terms of Hong Kong, Australia and New Zealand for those longer breaks. But yes, Italy is definitely in the top three.
Okay, do we go through trends? Do we have year? I mean, it feels like last year everyone went to Greece, a couple of years before that, Croatia. Are we imagining it?
No, I think so. Again, from the survey that we conducted recently, one of the other interesting statistics that came out of it was that our customers were saying they're very influenced, about 35%, by where friends and family are travelling to, and then also by social media, which I guess there's a crossover there, right, if you're looking at your friends and family's social media. But if you have a look at the moment with particularly the low-cost carriers flying from the UAE into Italy, there has been an increase in terms of airlines and destinations. So I think, you know, Air Arabia, Wizz Air, Fly Dubai, and then Emirates and Etihad all fly to anywhere between 1 and 5 cities across Italy. Fly Dubai is the one that goes to the most, with 5 different spots, and that has increased very much so over the last couple of years. I think it's a difficult question because it makes you wonder, is it it's a bit the chicken and the egg scenario, right? Is it that there's more supply, so the prices are better, so then demand increases? Or is it that the airlines are putting on more flights because the demand is there? Obviously, I don't work in airline network planning, but I would assume that obviously, you know, that there is demand that can be seen in order for them to justify putting the routes on.
But the demand has to start somewhere. What's the initial egg, if you like?
It's a very interesting question. I don't actually know if I know the answer to that
is
question, if I'm honest.
Because I know Vietnam was definitely driven by flights in, you know, some of these places for the first time.
So there's a couple of things actually I've seen in the past is if a country's comes out with much easier visa rules. So, you know, like the Georgias and the Azerbaijans of the world, they came out and said, we will do visa-free for UAE residents. We definitely see that spike. That's not the case with Europe, because we've actually been having more challenges from a Schengen visa perspective. I think at the moment, the next appointment for a Schengen visa is about September. So if you haven't already got one, you will have missed out. But I do, you know, obviously as airlines have more seats to sell, they will do more advertising, people see a better rate, and then we all start to, I think, follow suit. So, yeah.
Where are we on the visa front? Because I know, I mean, even Rich trying to book for his family has had to change plans a couple of times due to visa issues.
Yes. So we did see quite a strong level of inquiry for Europe for short breaks for Eid. And we unfortunately saw a huge amount of those people having to change plans to other destinations that had easier visa rules because they just couldn't get the appointments in time. So I think with the interesting thing is obviously summer is a peak for Europe in terms of that travel, and we've always had issues with needing to plan far enough in advance to get your Schengen visa. I think it's just a bit of a double down at the moment between there being a backlog and those issues, as well as it being a peak period.
What about volumes of travel? I mean, if I think of last summer, we had various Eids and holidays and school holidays all coming together, yes, which meant that summer seemed to last for about 6 months. Mm. And town really emptied out. Are we likely to see the same again?
I don't think so, because the Eid al-Adha break last year was very close to the school holidays, and so a lot of people took that and extended their holiday break, whereas this year there is that, I think, about a 2 to 3 week space in between, so they're not tacking it on together. We did see that happen with the spring break and Eid, because obviously that a lot of people went from a 2 week to a 3 week break. We've also had quite a lot of feedback from the hotels locally as well in terms of staycations. They've said that already there are about 80% occupancy for the Eid break, so a lot of people booking staycations, and that they do believe that they will have a fairly strong summer as well for people staying around.
About 30 seconds left with you. We spoke to the boss of Dubai Tourism at ATM. We've spoken to a couple of people who have suggested that seasonality is changing in terms of people coming in, that summer is becoming a lot more popular. What are you seeing in the inwards?
Yes, I would agree with that. We definitely don't get the same level of peaks and troughs that we did. We used to always see summer would come and we'd get unbelievable staycation offers trying to fill up there as well. But we're definitely not seeing, it's I guess, smoothed out a bit more.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning. Emily Jenkins, Head of Product Development at DW Travel. Do you stand up the business breakfast Italian job hypothesis?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty solid one. I definitely think we're seeing the trends. One of the other things which very interesting based on some feedback recently was that a lot of customers have started going to Italy to do their shopping as well, because they used to do it in the UK, and obviously the tax-free thing has been an issue.
There you go, filling up the shopping bags this summer. Thank you so much for joining us, Emily.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Richard's swapping commodities. He's going from oil to gold.
I'm going off to find my gold mine. I'll be working down my gold mine. I'll be working down my gold mine.
Because we're joined in the studio by a real live gold miner, John Reed. His day job now is Chief Market Strategist at the World Gold Council in London. But for many years, he was a gold miner in South Africa. Morning, John.
Good morning.
We'll get on to your history underground in a short while. But first of all, let's talk about gold and the gold price. Massively important to Dubai. That's why you're here. We hit a record high just a few weeks ago. What's the story?
Well, it's not just one record high. We've had a whole series of them this year. Gold has traded really strongly, not just against the US dollar, but against all the currencies in the world. And I think the story is enormous demand from emerging markets, whether that's emerging market central banks, whether that's emerging market jewelry buyers, whether it's investors in physical gold, even buyers of gold ETFs out of India and China. This has been an emerging market story, while the West isn't really that bothered at the moment about buying gold.
Well, let's talk at the physical market. You're going to be down in the gold suit during your trip to Dubai, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I was chatting with your colleague Andrew, actually, who's based here in Dubai, about 4 weeks ago when gold did hit a record high. We went down to the gold suit together. And he said, in China, they're still buying jewellery, still buying physical gold, undeterred by the record high price. But India and Dubai, a bit more price sensitive, and the physical jewellery buying had tailed off a little bit. What are you seeing from your bigger picture macro view?
I think that's right. I mean, I think one of the things we've seen this year has been Chinese buyers, retail buyers of gold jewelry and investment products, being prepared to chase the price higher, sort of tied up in the momentum of the story. Whereas on the Indian subcontinent, in the Middle East, we've seen more price sensitivity. And that's fairly typical. I've always considered particularly Indian gold buyers to be very savvy. You know, when the price goes up a lot, they'll slow down their purchases and stand back from the market a bit, wait for gold to correct. But when it does correct, they'll come back in and buy. And that's very much what we've seen. So yes, 4 weeks ago at an all-time high, we were seeing a slowdown in purchases in India specifically. But now that gold is perhaps $100 off its highs, the reports we're hearing from India is that business has picked up and it's being keenly bought. And really, that's one of the things we've noted over the last 6 months. Gold goes up, investors and speculators buy it. When it corrects, it doesn't correct very far because people who've missed it come back in and buy it.
What about central banks? I know you look at something called the Gold Return Attribution Model, or GRAM.
Yeah.
What does that tell us about central banks, like the Fed or the UAE Central Bank?
Yeah, I mean the biggest driver of gold returns over the longer term is the US dollar and US interest rates. And GRAM, which is attempts to decompose the moves in gold into the various drivers underneath, usually shows that the dollar and interest rates are the biggest factors. Interesting thing that's come out of GRAM in the last few months is that there is a residual component here. Now, this residual component basically means things we can't explain. And the things we can't explain from our modeling has been the biggest contributor to gold's returns over the last few months. Now, that's really interesting to me because we like to think we understand the gold market really well. I've been doing this for 38 years in one form or another. And when gold is performing better than we can immediately explain, that's when it gets interesting. That's when it becomes a bit of a detective hunt to try and work out what the drivers are going on.
A quick word on cryptocurrencies. Is Bitcoin the new gold?
No, it's not. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but I'm saying it's different from gold. If you look at the correlations of Bitcoin versus equity markets, they're very different from the correlations of gold and equity markets. So if you own gold and you're attracted to Bitcoin, or indeed other crypto assets, don't think you're substituting one for the other. If you own Bitcoin, effectively what you've done is you've geared up your equity portfolio with really high potential returns, positive and negative. So what you need if you have a riskier portfolio is you need more diversification. So they're actually complementary to each other rather than competitive.
Let's talk about getting gold out of the ground. I alluded to this earlier. You started, your degree is in mining, and you started your career 38 years ago. You mentioned that, spending almost a decade underground in South Africa. Mm. Where are we now with the mining industry?
Well, globally, the mining industry has been expanding its production. In fact, in the first quarter of 2024, hit a record first quarter production level for gold, up 4% year on year. And that sort of makes sense when you think of gold prices hitting record highs. But beyond the performance of the last 12 months or so, the industry seems to have roughly peaked in production around 2018. So we saw rapid growth in global mine production between 2008 and 2018. But for the last 6 or 7 years, we've been unable to break through the record high production levels, although we probably will this year. Gold mines are hard to find, expensive to develop, and very difficult to get the government and environmental permits that you need to build. So it's getting ever harder to open a new gold mine. And mines aren't like factories. You can't build a mine and expect it to last forever. Eventually, you mine all the gold that's available. So I don't see a massive increase in mine production as a consequence of these record high gold prices. And in fact, the longer term trends for the industry may be towards this plateauing, even slow declines, perhaps over the longer term.
We occasionally get very excited press releases out of Saudi Arabia that they found new gold reserves. Mm. And then you look at it in the context of global gold reserves and realize it's like less than 1%. Mm. There's not much gold in this region, is there?
There is not much gold production in this region, but putting a geological hat on for a moment, the African Nubian Shield, which is the what they refer to as the area from basically Egypt right the way through to Saudi Arabia, has the potential to produce much more gold than it's doing at the moment. As you can imagine, in countries which have been dominated by hydrocarbon production, gold has never been particularly important. But now these economies are trying to diversify. We're seeing more exploration taking place. So there is a good potential for growth to come through from production in this region. But it's never going to rival, I think, some of the larger producing regions like, you know, Nevada or Western Australia.
Finally, John, let me talk to you about aeroplanes. You're based in London. You're here in Dubai. You're flying back to London, your home, in a day or two's time. Then you're flying from London to Singapore. You were telling me before we came on air, you are on flight SQ321. That's the one that had the turbulence where, very sadly, a gentleman died. As a frequent business traveller, how do these turbulence stories affect you?
Well, I'm not scared of flying because I couldn't do my job if I was. But I've always had the habit of keeping my seatbelt on long flights. I have been bounced around in aircraft before, nowhere near as bad as the tragic events that we saw just recently. But the one thing it's made me do is tighten that seatbelt up a little bit more when I go to sleep. I always keep it on when I'm seated in a flight, and now I just make sure that it's that bit tighter.
John, safe travels. Appreciate you joining us in the studio this morning. Thanks very much indeed for your time. John Reid is the Chief Market Strategist of the World Gold Council. It's the Business Breakfast.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Saud Abu Al-Shawarab. He's the EVP of Industrial at Dubai Industrial City. Ahlan wa sahlan. Morning, Saud. Good to have you with us. So much about industry this week. We had the Make It in the Emirates event in Abu Dhabi this week. About 30 billion dirhams thereabouts of new investment announced. But the question that we all had is, well, where are they going to build all these factories? And then hot on the heels of that, you announced this massive new tranche of land for industrial development, 14 million square feet. I crunched the numbers last night. That's about the size of Karama in Dubai. Tell us more.
First of all, thank you for hosting me. It's a pleasure to be here. So Make It in the Emirates is a very important industrial event that the UAE hosts every year. So as Dubai Industrial City, we would like to position ourselves as the leaders to be part of this event and to be the drivers of the industrial growth in the country and Dubai in specific. So this is the third year that we participate. And we this year we became the diamond sponsor for the event, and as what you've mentioned, we have announced close to 14 million square feet of additional industrial land inventory that will cover the need and the growth of the industrial sector requirement in the Emirate of Dubai. So as of last quarter, we've reached 97% occupancy in our industrial land lease inventory. And this is an automatic announcement and efforts that we are putting in place to make sure that we have enough inventory to cover the growth of the sector in the UAE and Dubai in specific.
Well, let's take a step back and look at Dubai Industrial City. A full disclosure, it's part of TCOM Group, which ultimately is part of Dubai Holding, our parent company. Fine, that's out of the way. Brandy and I were chatting earlier on about 6:30, and a few things about Dubai Industrial City we didn't know. One of them being, I think of it as being relatively new. I think of Jebel Ali as being, having been around for decades and decades. But I was looking at your LinkedIn profile last night. You've been working there nearly 18 years. It's not that new, is it?
Yes. So I was one of the few new joiners that joined Dubai Industrial City, and the project was launched in 2004. Our master plan was completed on end of 2005, and since then we were building and developing Dubai Industrial City. We proudly can say that end of last year we exceeded more than 1,000 business partners within our ecosystem, with a growth of 17% compared to the year before. So this shows how the industrial sector in Dubai is in a very healthy stage, and it really contributes heavily towards the GDP of the Emirate. And as everyone knows, the Dubai Industrial City is strategically located 15 minutes away from Jebel Ali Port, 10 minutes away from Al Maktoum Airport, and we have the second largest railway station terminal in the UAE is hosted in Dubai Industrial City, and phase one is operational as we speak. We are bounded by the major highways, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Roads 311 and Emirates Road 611. So when you talk about connectivity, the ease of doing business, it really positions Dubai Industrial City in a very strategic location and gives an advantage for business partners to reach anywhere around the world, manufacturing in Dubai Industrial City and exporting to the world.
Well, let's talk about the companies who are going to take up this space, because you've clearly done a lot of planning. Now, you spend just over 400 million dirhams to buy the land, so it's quite a significant investment by you. And I'm looking at the kind of companies that are there. 1,000 companies, 300 factories. Some of them are household names. Unilever, making shampoo and stuff. Other companies we've never heard of. Zambian firm Neelkant Cables, just last week, opening a 130 million dirham facility there. So who's going to take up this new space?
It's different sectors. We are talking from food and beverage companies to base metal to, we're seeing good demand on building material sector, chemical, machinery equipment, and there is a very positive movement on transport even. So that combination really gives a broad focus on different sectors that complements whatever the country needs in terms of production and manufacturing, and even exporting those goods to neighboring country and the region and maybe the world. So it's a different mix. We have the full ecosystem as we speak. You've mentioned 300 factories. Those 300 factories are from brick and mortar production to logistic services and packaging companies to recycling facilities. And earlier this year, as part of our circular economy and the master plan that we've designed, we have a lot of recycling companies that are establishing their facilities in Dubai Industrial City. And earlier in February, we've inaugurated Dubat. Dubat is the first battery recycling facility that reproduces lithium that is being exported, 75% of it, to battery companies again to produce new batteries. So we are talking about sustainability. We incorporate sustainability in our ecosystem. So most of the factories that produce products that is made in UAE is decarbonized in terms of carbon emissions. And we generate more than 50 megawatt through our factories of renewable energy. And we have good number of factories that have zero waste to landfill. So talking about those topics, it really positioned that, yes, we are a main industrial developer, but we are leaders in what we do, and we have amazing factories that incorporates the latest technologies and sustainability initiatives within their factory designs.
Saud, we've only got about less than a minute left with you. I'm looking on your website, and as well as the usual USPs that a business park like you would have, the roads, the electricity network, all of these things, you say we have a robust stormwater drainage network. I wonder, is that a new thing that you've put on your website following the floods 6 weeks ago, or has that always been front of mind for your investors?
We are a large development. We are 55 kilometers in size. And with the incidents that happened last month, I think we've managed with the government to handle such incident that was abnormal. And the infrastructure supported the ecosystem that we offer.
So does that mean you're improving the stormwater drainage at the moment, like a lot of places
with the
are?
Growth of inventory, for sure, we will be investing in having more infrastructure that supports the growth of the number of factories that are under construction.
Well, there's clearly no shortage of demand at the moment. Wish you the best of luck with that new initiative. 14 million new square feet, the size of Karama in Dubai. Saud Abu Al-Shawarab, EVP of Industrial Dubai Industrial City. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.